Session number 4841, reel 5.
Major Petey, reel 5.
These star shells seem to light up the whole of the Pacific. I'd never seen anything like it before. But the ship carried on in beautiful calm seas, and then we were told that we were going to dock at Vancouver at 10 o'clock in the morning. And about 9 o'clock, as we were nearing the coast, it seemed to me that every small boat that could possibly go to sea had come out to meet us. And all the sirens and hooters going and flags. And the ship crept in towards the dock. The Implacable was a big ship, 35,000 tons. And the tugs came out to take us in. But the skipper of Implacable would not have any tugs. And we went straight in under our own power to what I believe is called a camber. It's a sort of a dead-end dock. And I really thought the bows of the ship were going to crush against the stone wall at the end. But I saw the sailors on deck with the heaving lines ready to throw ashore. And just as the town clock struck 10, out went the heaving lines. And I thought, there's the British Navy. 10 o'clock it was. Well, the Canadians had laid on trains, and I came away in one of the first trains. I think it must have been the first. They were the ones that had been used for the old immigrant traffic many, many years before. But we officers had first-class sleeping accommodation, which was really basically just berths one above the other. And it was absolutely marvellous. We wound our way up through the Rockies and came to places with fascinating names like Medicine Hat and White Horse Springs. And I was able to spend one or two of my Canadian dollars, which I'd got from the English pounds I got on Implacable. So there were little things that we could get on the journey across. And another of these extraordinary coincidences happened. When we were up at White Horse Springs, a Canadian Red Cross girl approached me and said, I want to send a cable for you. And I said, oh, thanks very much. There's no need for that. I've already sent my wife a cable. When we landed in Vancouver, I was able to get a cable away to her, telling her I was on the way. The actual wording was, kill the fatted calf, I'm on my way. But she said, oh, but I've got strict instructions. I must send a cable to somebody. Haven't you got any relations in Canada? And I said, no. I thought, yes, I have. I've got a very distant cousin who settled in Canada after the First World War, Cousin Harry. Now, what was his surname? I remember it, Harry Frampton. So I said, I've got one relation, very distant in Canada. I know his name's Harry Frampton. I know he took up fruit farming, and I know he lives somewhere near Niagara. So she said, right, we'll send him a telegram. We'll find him. So she sent a telegram, message, with that rather vague description. She also did it to Canadian Red Cross headquarters, and they sent out their scouts. And when we got to, I think it must have been Montreal, my cousin Harry Frampton met the train and got on board with me. And I had all the latest news because, as I mentioned, he'd served in the First World War. When the Second World War broke out, he'd volunteered again. He'd been sent to Britain with the Canadian Scottish. And when they discovered his true age, they made him into an instructor. Wouldn't let him do any more fighting, actually. And he was in camp at Winchester, and only 2 weeks before I saw him, he'd been in my home. The most remarkable series of events. Now, I can't remember which order the railway stations go. We came on the Canadian Pacific, but he got on board, I think that it was Montreal, and he got off again after travelling with me probably 150 miles and went back home again. But we had a long, long chat in the train in that way. I must really look at the map and see where those stations are. And it certainly was on the Canadian Pacific Railway. At any rate, this train, after 5 nights and 4 days of travel, we ended up in Nova Scotia at a place called Truro. And I think we stayed there 18 days, feeling rather frustrated and impotent. And then we were all taken down to the old liner La France, and she came back across the Atlantic. I'd sent her a letter when we arrived in Truro, saying to my wife, I don't know how things are going to work out, but I'll get home as soon as I can, and the one thing I want to see is you and the children at my own front door. But as I walked down the gangway off La France, they were at the foot of the gangway, and I couldn't do anything. It was so unexpected, I didn't know what to say to them. I'd been fixed in my mind that once I got my foot on English soil, I was going to get the bus, and I was going to go to Winchester, and I was going to go and knock on my own front door. And to meet my wife and the three children at the foot of the gangway, I just didn't know what to say or do. There were buses waiting to take us to a camp on Southampton Common for the inevitable medical inspections, etc. And I sort of gave each one a kiss and said, well, I've got to get in the bus now. Still in this mental attitude that you've got to do whatever you're told, rather. And I've often, often regretted that. I'm sorry it didn't work out the way I had planned it, or I'm sorry that I didn't know that my wife had been there. If she'd been able to get a message to the ship so that I could have been ready to see them, it would have been so different. But, you see, she didn't know what ship I was coming on. She only knew I was on the move somewhere in the Atlantic. And I don't think the War Office had any details of all this complicated movement. It was pretty well done. But, I don't see what else could be done in the circumstances. Coming back on La France, we had 24 majors in one cabin. It was a pretty tight fit.
Did you have to be processed once you got back to England?
Yes, we stayed in a camp on Southampton Common, and I remember no less than 11 doctors of different sorts. Some test your eyes, some test your blood, some test just other samples. Some, I think, asked you just questions to see if you were still sane. That I don't really know, but there were 11 people. But then having been through that, I was able to telephone my wife, and she came down with our little car. We had a Riley then. She came down and picked me up and had a day with her, I think it was, and then had to go back to the camp on the common. And then we sort of were properly kitted out, etc., and awaiting any posting, we had, looking back at it, it must have been sort of a rehabilitation course at Bicester, where there was an ordnance depot. And we sort of went through the paperwork and found out what had changed and so on. And then I was posted to Thatcham, which at that time was an American Army General Stores depot, just near Aldermaston. Put there as British liaison officer. Well, it was a sinecure, really, because they were sort of closing down, and we were getting ready to take over from Ordnance Depot near Basingstoke. Bramley. They were going to take over. And it wasn't really a very happy time of my life, because everything was turmoil again, and I found that the Brigadier, or the Colonel King, who I mentioned right when we were talking at the start, he was now a Brigadier, and he was a Didcot. And so I wrote to him and said, had he got a vacancy anywhere amongst his staff there? And it wasn't long after that I was posted to Didcot, and with Colonel King again. settled down very happily then to, as officer in charge of coordination and planning, which was the cleaning up of all these little sub-depots which ordnance depots had had to disperse their stores. We had 64 depots, ranging from Swindon, it was the most southerly one, to one just by Ayr in Scotland. And it was quite a job sorting out the stores and getting them all back into Derby, because I then went from Didcot to Derby.
Do you think that your period of imprisonment left any long-term effects with you in any way?
Oh, yes, very definitely. Two distinct things. From the mental point of view, I've become very, very introvert. Find it very hard to mix with other people, very hard to talk easily with other people. Extremely difficult. It's only when I'm with one or two people, as we are talking now, that I open up and talk freely. If I go to anything like a horticultural society meeting where there's a crowd pushing around, I get a sort of agoraphobia saying, let me out of here, I want to get out. It's not the same as claustrophobia. I don't think I'd mind being shut in a lift or door, but getting stuck in a crowd and be sort of feeling that I can't get out of it really gets me on, right on edge. And the strange thing is I belong to a club now called the Probus Club, which is for retired business and professional men, and they organise lots of things like theatre outings. Now, if I go on one of these, I have to take tranquilizers first, because I know that I've got to wait until everybody's ready to go, and I'm tied to the movements of that coach. If I go on my own to the theatre, well, I never do, as long as I've got the feeling that I can get up and go when I want, I'm perfectly all right. But if I go to the theatre even with my wife, and she's enjoying the play and I'm not, I can't say to myself, I must go now because I've got to wait for her. And then I start to get almost on the boil. That's the mental side of it. And of course, physically, I'm feeling now the things are really catching up with me in the old age. I didn't know it at the time, but I must have developed a duodenal ulcer then, and I've lived with it ever since. And all the doctors that I saw, oh, it's just indigestion, this, that and the other, but it's only in the past, about 5 years ago, that anybody thought of having an X-ray, and they said, oh, you've got a duodenal ulcer. And I said, well, what's the cause of duodenal ulcers? They said, well, it could be worry. And I said, well, I was worried while I was a POW, and that was when I noticed all these pains. And they said, well, that must have been it, which doesn't help you all that much. And another thing I've got, but whether it's connected with the POW time or not, I don't know, is I've got hiatus hernias up here. And of course now Anno Domini is catching up with me. I've got aches and pains, some osteoarthritis. Started using a walking stick to get about and so on.
What about the Japanese? What do you feel about the Japanese now?
I still feel that I wouldn't buy a Japanese car. I wouldn't buy anything Japanese if I could find an adequate alternative. I've got a lot of antipathy. I won't say hatred, that's not it, but I just don't want anything more to do with them. I admire their skill and their cleverness and their ingenuity and all that they've achieved, but it seems to me to be such a strange thing that we win wars and we lose the peace. It's a cliche, but I mean, we saw it after the First World War, and goodness me, we seem to be seeing it again now.
I think that there were two things that happened to you which might have prevented you becoming a POW at all that you were telling me about earlier.
Yes, looking back, it was when we were on City of Canterbury. I was walking along the passageway one time and the ship was rolling a bit, and I put my hand up against the plating and thought it was terribly hot. And then I thought to myself, well, I suppose it would be in the Indian Ocean, anyhow. But a bit later, a steward came with skipper's compliments, sir, would you come up and see him on the bridge? So I went up and we had a chat for a bit. And he said, well, what I wanted to talk to you about is, he said, the ship's on fire. And this was rather a surprise. But he said, well, we've got the alternative now of what we might do. We might go full steam ahead, which is 12 and a half knots, to get to the Maldive Islands. Or we can throw the burning coal overboard. I should have said that one of the coal bunkers had caught a light, spontaneous combustion, and there were about 200 tons of coal burning. Well, it's one of these times when you can look back and say that what you said then directed your life to a certain extent, because I said, well, let's throw it in the furnaces and keep going. And so I asked for volunteers, and I had 417 officers and men, and every single man volunteered to go down and help with this burning coal. Well, now, there were also Navy and RAF men on board the ship, and not one of them volunteered, although they had the opportunity. But number 4 Ordnance Store Company dug all that burning coal out and took it along to the stoke holes, and the Lascar shoveled it into the ship's boilers. And so we kept going, and we arrived at Singapore. If I had said, skipper, it's a nautical matter, nothing to do with an army man, we might have gone to the Maldive Islands, where there might have been a shore fire brigade that might have put the fire out, and you're left up wondering what might have been. The other occasion, which I always have looked back at a turning point, was the night before the fall of Singapore. A Corporal Noakes and a private mariner came to see me, and they said that they could see that the fall of Singapore was imminent, and that they and some others had got a launch which was down in Keppel Harbour. They were going to make a getaway, and they kept a place for me. So I said, well, I can't possibly come with you. I couldn't look at any of the other people again if I took the opportunity like that. You ought really to be shot for desertion in the face of the enemy, but unofficially, good luck to you. I hope you get away with it. So off they went, and I stayed in Singapore. Well, it was after the war that I saw a letter in the local paper from somebody called Mariner complaining that, having been a POW in the Far East, he couldn't, the planners wouldn't let him set up in business as a grocer on his war gratuity, and it was signed Mariner. And so I went to the Hampshire Chronicle, or wrote to the Hampshire Chronicle box office, saying if by any chance it was the same man, come and see me. And it was the very man I'd last seen on the railway station at Singapore. So I asked for his story, and when he and Corporal Noakes got back to the quayside, the launch had got tired of waiting for them, and it had gone. And so they got in a sampan and pushed off. And when they got out in the middle of the harbour, they found there were no oars. And so they lifted up the floorboards and paddled, and they eventually arrived at Sumatra. A Chinaman sort of took charge of them there and got them down to Java. From Java, they were sent to India to be court-martialed in face of the desertion in face of the enemy. Both went in the 14th Army through the Burma campaign, and both became warrant officers class 1, which was more use than I ever was. I think that the Japanese always had in mind that they would do everything that they could to humiliate us and try and make us look silly, because they said on one occasion that I always made a mock of them, which was never my intention. But the sort of thing that they did, which I always felt was to humiliate us, was concerned on one occasion with shoes. We always, when we got on to our palliasse or our bank, etc., had to leave our shoes or boots facing with the toes pointing away from ourselves. And on one occasion, we were all called out, all 1,200 of us, out onto the parade ground, because one man had left them with the heels outwards instead of the toes. And he was made to come out in front of the whole parade in about 30 degrees of frost and repeat out loud, "Oh, honourable shoes, I am sorry I put you to bed the wrong way round." And then we were all allowed to go back and get to sleep again. And that is the silly sort of harassment which we continually having from time to time